Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. It's May 24th and there are a lot of trucks outside, so this isn't going to be very long. Even though we've shut the windows, it's still the jackhammers are going to start in the next few minutes.
Tearing up our street to do, because there's absolutely nothing wrong with the street. They had, you know, there's lots of streets in Binghamton that have potholes. And
it's
awful.
Like driving in a third world country for most of town.
But our street must have just been paved like 5 years ago.
Yeah, right. I think right before we moved in.
Right. So I'm not sure why.
Well, many people have told me it's because somebody important lives on our street. I don't know who it is, but.
But does that importance give you the right to have loud, obnoxious machines at a...
No, I think it means that
it's like a privilege. If I were this important person, I would say,
"Don't you ever do my street again? How dare you?"
I don't see how this is a perk.
Yeah, it's not. It's been terrible, especially since we just stopped working on our house. So we were just beginning to battle the house dust, and now the street dust is filtering through our open windows because we took out all the storm windows and put in screens. Just for such
it's
a time
fine
as this.
Dust. It's very, very, yeah, it's comes, like silky dust.
Yeah.
It comes right through the holes. It's great.
So we also don't have anything to talk about.
Well, there's plenty to talk about, but we decided to take a step back from.
We don't want to talk about
controversy for a week because we're exhausted.
So we do one of our famous and beloved what are we reading?
Yeah, well, because before that isn't when you're writing a review that's probably gonna get you in trouble, aren't you?
Yeah,
so we won't talk about it, but
let's not talk about it today. I don't want to talk about it. I have to write it, and I actually have a big draft. I think I get to have maybe, I don't know, 1500 words, and I have like 8000 on the page right now. So, today I'm going to be cutting words out of a document. But that's not what I... So, what are you reading?
Well, this is for the first time in maybe 7 months. No, probably about shorter than that. 5 months. I'm not reading a biography of Hitler. I've read 4 or 5 biographies of Hitler. And so I feel like I'm well-versed. The topic. So,
is it time to move on to another totalitarian dictator? Or
well, no. I'm on a Vietnam War kick. So I was reading. I was actually on a Indochina War kick for a while. So I was reading Bernard Fall, who's a French writer or a reporter, really, who's a part of the, really was one of the. A member of the French resistance during World War II. Like everyone now, if you go to France and you ask everybody, the entire country was part of the resistance, but really in reality, only very few French people were part of the resistance. Many of them were part of the collaboration, but
don't
Bernard
say that.
Fall, Bernard Fall was part of the resistance. And unlike many of the resistance fighters, he was an anti-communist rather than a communist. And so he, after the war, he knew a lot about military stuff and counterinsurgency and insurgency. And so he went to Indochina, where France was trying to cling to her colony there. Because after the war, America, the United States thought of World War II as a great fight for freedom. And England and France did too, sort of, but they also, England thought of it as we've got to hold on to our empire, and France, after coming out of the humiliation of World War II,
wanted
to reclaim the glory of the old regime, and so they couldn't let go of colonies, and
it got really, really brutal,
right,
like in Algeria,
right. So Indochina preceded the fighting in Algeria, but it was a good foreshadowing of the kind of
what was going to happen.
And the French just didn't have the resources. I mean, the only reason they hung on as long as they did is because the Americans, who at first were really friendly toward Ho Chi Minh, the communist leader of the Viet Minh, but then when they realized he was really communist, they thought he was kind of a nationalist, but then they realized he was really communist, and the Chinese and the Soviets were interested in helping out, they changed their tune and said, well, okay, we'll help the colonists. We'll help the colonizing French because of anti-communism, which I understand. I mean, hey, at the time, it looked like, this is one of the things that the pet peeve, you know, you look in the 90s, I remember in college taking several classes on the Cold War, and excuse me, early Cold War, there was this thing called the domino theory where the idea was that because communism is not communism in one nation is not the ideal.
It needs to be communism over the worldwide,
right? So if one nation falls, then of course the communists within that nation are going to be sending insurgency groups into the nation surrounding them, and pretty soon you have this kind of domino effect where sister nation falls, and America would be isolated and all alone. So we've got to get out there and stop the dominoes from falling. And one domino is, you know, into China. So Bernard Fall, anyway, he was a brilliant writer. He's really good. So he wrote probably a classic military history of the Indochina War. It's called Street Without Joy. And just if you want very good writing, and he doesn't do a step-by-step history of the war. He gives little vignettes and glimpses into what life was like for the soldiers on both sides. He does give really detailed accounts of battles, and some diary entries explaining from perspective of people who are there, but why they're there. Why are you?
I'm just thinking, like, all of this sounds so, so fascinating.
You wouldn't want to read that? I kept thinking I was reading this. Anne would like this. But... you wouldn't.
Like, you've given me all the information ever want.
Well, you like France, and you like...
Everything I know about Indochina is from that movie called Indochine with Catherine Deneuve. That's all I ever am going to know about it.
So, Bernard Fall also wrote the classic history of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, which was the final... battle. It wasn't the final battle. It was the one that just ended the thing. After Dien Bien Phu, no one thought that France could hold out, and it was just it was terrible. They decided to make a grand show of their military force by trying to provoke the communists into a set piece battle, and so they parachute in several regiments into a valley, not thinking. Not believing that the communists would be able to haul heavy artillery up to the ridges all around the valley. So they ended up just parachuting into a death trap. The national pride was at stake so much that
they just did it.
Even though they were, when they realized, oh no, now we're all going to die. Other French paratroopers from outside volunteered to go in. So people just kept throwing themselves into this hole.
That's horrible.
It's very heroic and very, French Foreign Legion and all that, but it was horrible.
That's horrible. It's like the advertisement for the US military, the new cartoon with set against the Russian. Where if Emma Malone with her two moms goes into the Valley of Death.
I mean,
because the American military now is about diversity and equal rights, and not about like going into
I don't think that
Americans would be up for a battle situation like the one you've just described.
No, they would not be up. I mean, maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that people I'm sure the U.S. Army Rangers have their standards and various, but if that presages our future in Malone, then no, I mean, give it 20 years and then we're done with that kind of thought about the military. But anyway, they fought to the end, and the communist family overran the base. They took 3,000 prisoners, I think, and of those, only like 1/3 returned home. Some broke out. I think it was like very few broke out, but it was just a terrible, terrible battle. People, French look back on it with pride because it was like, so I guess it was a little like our Alamo, but less necessary. I mean, you didn't have to do that. The Alamo stalled Santa Ana a little bit so that Sam Houston could gather an army. So there was a purpose for it, but this was
just for the glory and nothing, and the defeat. Glory,
France, right? So yeah, and then after that, that meant so a lot of the people who took part in the French Indochina War, a lot of the really good military men who were also very conservative, been transferred over to Algeria.
Oh.
And they clung to that. You know, there were a lot of very conservative French settlers in Algeria, and so they actually started to try and a revolution against France and Algeria, because France had thought was going liberal with Charles de Gaulle, who is that known liberal.
Well, the French. So I just read this morning that Emmanuel Macron, they think is done because of the right. He was reading this is a liberal thing. His far right coming at him is his own fault, and he's gonna not last long, I guess. I don't know. What I started to read it. I didn't read all of it there, but you know, Algeria is always at the root of every big problem that France continues to have. Because they really didn't do a nice thing there.
Are you going somewhere?
No, I'm getting my book.
Oh. So anyway, this Bernard Fall guy who writes all these wonderful things, really great writer, he also stays on for the American involvement in Vietnam, which Indochina is Laos and Vietnam together, and the Vietnam after the French left Vietnam, they became their own kind of thing, and in Thailand, but so the Vietnam at the end of the French Indochina War, Ho Chi Minh and southern leaders of the Vietnamese people decide to partition, along with the help from the Soviets and the Americans, decide to partition Vietnam in the north and south. It's a very thin country. You should be able to defend a line. But then the leaders that America chooses, and it really is America choosing, are just horrible. They're tyrants. They're dictators. They're nationalists, but they have no sense of the political need to give the people a bone. While the communists, who are also brutal, I mean, one of the things I like this, I'm reading right now is Vietnam, An Epic Tragedy by Max Hastings, who's also a journalist, but he's also a pretty good historian. And he's very good. He's an English person, so he doesn't have the political baggage that Americans have when they're, I've read it before, this is my second reading. Americans have a lot of political baggage when we look back at Vietnam. So you're either going to write it as a hippie looking back and thinking, oh, this is terrible, or you're going to look back as a conservative and say, oh, we should have just poured more money and guns into the, yeah. And if the politicians got in the way, if the politicians got out of the way, we'd win the war. But Max Hastings is a British guy. He doesn't have any kind of skin in the game, but he's very fair. So he will do what the hippies won't do. He'll go back and say, look, there were some reasons to be there. The North Vietnamese are brutal. They were horrible. They were Stalinists. They weren't freedom fighters. They were, they published a lot of propaganda in the South about how everybody has, 40 acres and a mule, but they were impoverished and starving, as most communist systems turn out to do. And then, So, but the difference is the American reporters and Western reporters didn't investigate that. They were far more interested in how bad the South was. So, all we heard was, there are dictator puppet regimes in South Vietnam, and there's no reason sending American boys to die for those things. So anyway, it's a great, Bernard Fall is not the writer of this book, but he does, Bernard Fall dies in Vietnam accompanying an American unit just doing reporting. And he steps on a landmine and die, or either it is a mortar blast or it's a landmine, and he dies. It's kind of tragic. He dies in 1964, and he doesn't get to write the history of the Vietnam War from.
Even though that's where he was hoping to do.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm reading, those are the books I'm reading right now. Are you fascinated?
I have learned so much just now that I didn't know. Which is an important thing. So, well, I'm reading several books. I'm halfway through Anthony Trollope's The Prime Minister and the Palliser series. I think there's only one more book after this one, which is really upsetting to me. And the thing that I like about it is, especially as I'm thinking of writing this review, well, I am going to write it. It's not that I'm not going to write it. But it's interesting to read Trollope, who was, from the Victorian era. And unlike Dickens, I think that Trollope was a real Christian. Like he really was a churchgoer. He wasn't, a universalist or whatever. He was a member of the Church of England. And he writes women characters really well. Which is interesting to me. I'm always a little creeped out when a man can write a woman really well. I feel like that's unfair or weird. But he has really nuanced characters. All of the people are a little bit bad. All of the people, there's no like pure villain in Trollope, I would say. I mean, he's sympathetic to everyone. And this one,
although
has,
he's pretty brutal about the Jupiter.
Yeah, no, he's brutal about the Jupiter.
The press.
Yeah, the
he
press.
Hates, he hates the press.
He hates the press, and he hated it. He hates it in this too. That's true. There's no nuance there. They're always wicked. So, but one thing that's really struck me as I've been listening to this book is the assumption of obedience in marriage.
Like, that's great.
Well, it's strange. It's like seeing an aqueduct and not knowing what it is for me, I think, because the problems with that, the assumption that a woman will obey her husband in marriage, because the heroine of this book has married a bad person who is actually wicked. And it's beginning to dawn on her that the stuff he wants her to do is actually
evil.
And so she's trying to, that just never occurred to her, because of course a woman, when she gets married, obeys her husband. So that's been interesting, because I get the sense reading some of the books that are coming out today that, as we talked about last time, this idea that women either lived in a golden past where they were completely equal with everyone, and then the evil patriarchy came along and killed it, or they lived in a patriarchy and they all wanted out. They all wanted to get out from under that. And that's not the assumption of these books. Like, and I don't think that Trollope was, he wasn't a radical. He has characters who lived in the world in which they really lived. And so I think it's an interesting look at a time period that's much contested.
I mean, it would make you think twice about, if you lived in that world where it was just the cultural assumption that obey your
husband. You can't even think of the word. I know. It's so unusual.
Then that that does create a far more care about who you marry, doesn't it? I mean,
well, you would think so. And in some cases it does. Like, there's some women who dig in their heels and don't get married because they, you know, they don't want, they know that. In this case, this heroine kind of leaped into it again in the face of objections from everyone who
knew that she was going down the wrong road.
Yeah, but they couldn't tell her why. Their reasons for disliking the villain and isn't Trollope brings this out, that it's like bigotry. He's not English. He's not an English gentleman. He's foreign.
Oh.
And that's why they didn't like him. And it turns out that he is a villain, but it's not because he's foreign. It's because he's just bad. And that comes out, that nuance. Like, Trollope, you know, he at the same time makes you, it's repulsive, the attitude of the heroine's father towards this foreigner. Like, that's horrible. But also, he's right about the guy's character. So, but he can't, because he can't say it to her. He just only has, well, he's not English. So she's like, well, that's stupid. I'm, you know, whereas if he had been able to say.
Well, and also here's the reason he has bad character. In addition to his not being an Englishman.
Yeah, like, it's possibly because he, you know, he's, well, anyway. So it's interesting. I like these sorts of books. You would never get through it.
I liked Trollope when we were reading it as a family. I don't think I could read it by myself, because I would feel, I always feel this when I'm reading fiction, except when I'm reading Tolkien. When I'm reading fiction, I always feel like I'm wasting my time. Like, I'm not getting information.
It's terrible.
Like, I could be reading more about history.
I don't want
or the
information.
Bible or theology. Yeah. Gosh. And I feel like, so I feel like I'm like on vacation or something, and I feel guilty for sitting there reading fiction.
That's terrible. What are you, Victorian? Like, also, all the jokes, the slams against people who read novels in these books is really funny, because of course he's writing a novel. So it's really great. But that was short, and you talked for a long time, so can I say my other book? I'm still reading Green Thoughts, A Writer in the Garden by Eleanor Perini.
So I asked you yesterday, like, what should you do with the roses? And you didn't know.
No, because
you've been reading this book for a long time.
It's not a very practical book. It's wonderful. It's organized. It's alphabetical. So I finally got to the roses. But it's not about how to have roses. It's how roses have declined, that section. How roses have been bred to not be very nice anymore. And how old roses, rose breeders have done terrible things by taking the scent out of the roses. And it's true. If you feel like the roses of your childhood, and the sweet peas, incidentally, if your sense was that the sweet peas of your childhood smelled amazing, and now when you have sweet peas, they don't smell of anything, it's true, because they bred out the smell. And or at least they had in the 70s, and they've made it more complicated than it needed to be. So this is a wonderful, wonderful book, and it belongs to my mother.
Why would they breed this smell out of roses?
Because they sacrifice that to make the buds bigger and hardier in some cases.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there were reasons, but they gave up, you know, people go ahead and breed things without really thinking about what they're giving up when they choose certain traits. So, yeah, it's such a wonderful book, and it's true. I haven't learned anything. Like, I don't know how to organize my garden after reading this book.
So, I just don't understand why you'd spend that much time reading it.
Because it's so wonderful, and I've learned, well, it is full of history too. On the pruning section, it's really the history of pruning.
Okay, so if you merge,
it goes to Queen Elizabeth and King William and Rousseau and liberalism and Milton and Paradise Lost, and you know that all that is really important as you go into your garden.
Do you know how to prune things now?
No, I still have no idea. And that was the point of that section, is that no American does.
And I'm not going to tell you.
And I don't. Well, she does. She's American. She doesn't know either. So this book is so wonderful. I keep saying it, and I'm going to have to give it back to my mother. So that's going to be really heartbreaking, because I feel like it's worth reading over and over again, even though you can't know anything. I mean, I did learn from it that the thing that I've done with my asparagus is very bad. I didn't dig a big trench. I just put a lot of asparagus seeds straight into the ground. And now I have huge canes of asparagus that are very closely crowded together. And they're beautiful, but I don't know what to do, because I think their roots go down 10 feet and I can't get them out. So.
10 feet?
Yeah. Like I think I've created a catastrophe of asparagus, but I don't have there's nowhere in my garden I can dig a 50-foot trench for asparagus.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I just have asparagus crowded together for a long time, I guess, is what we'll have to do.
What, until we can like pay to bring a backhoe in? Should we get one of these guys to come in and so
dig out our asparagus?
Are you reading anything else?
The Bible.
Oh.
Are you reading the Bible?
No, I am reading the Bible, but I'm also reading. I can keep talking about the books I'm reading. Since you did all of yours in one go, I've just poured tea on myself. I'm reading Digital Minimalism, which I've said online a couple of times.
Okay, this is another I have a difference between you and me. So this is another reason I'm bevving you. Because you also read like self-help books.
Oh yeah, no, I love self-improvement books.
I can't stand them. I start reading. It's like church growth books. I start reading a self-help book or a church growth book, and it just makes me so irritated and annoyed. And I don't want to read someone's new gimmick about how to self-improve.
Well, it's not really a gimmick. I liked Deep Work a lot, because I like so many people have forgotten how to think in the age of social media. And so the Deep Work book helped me remember that it would be possible to think about something for more than 30 seconds before moving on to the next thing. And I need to actually read that book again, because it was very practical, but it also was a good case for why you should think deeply and why you shouldn't just be overtaken by the technologies of the day. So Digital Minimalism is very helpful. It's Cal Newport, and how you, I jumped into social media thoughtlessly. I just thought, oh yeah, these sound great. Twitter sounds like it'll be fun. And I signed up I can actually remember the moment when I signed up for Twitter. And now I have regrets-y.
Regrets.
And so he's framing the issue of social media. Not, I thought it would be, well, you should get rid of all of it now. But it's not. It's actually helpful to think through the what the platforms are trying to do to you, which I've known kind of, but he gathers all the information in one place.
Okay.
And then so you can legitimately say to yourself, no, I can't get off of Facebook or Twitter right now. Like, for whatever reason, these platforms do are a way that I engage with the world to one degree or another, either just observing. I mean, I don't really spend time on Twitter, but I do see what other people are saying on Twitter, and that helps me as a writer on the internet. Other people are writers in the garden. I'm a writer on the internet, which is really sad, but like a lot of what I write is comes from Twitter.
What you read on Twitter, right?
So I mean, maybe I should stop doing that and write about something else, but I'm pretty sure that if I wrote about the things that I was really interested, like Anthony Trollope, for instance, nobody would read me.
Twitter creates this weird universe of which I don't think actually exists outside of Twitter. Mm,
that's true.
It's a hothouse of theological fighting or political fighting that you don't find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when you're around people who totally disagree with you, you don't have
a Twitter. It's not like Twitter. No, yeah, you don't have a Twitter.
so it's helpful for seeing what's going on in some ways. Like, so I do like to see, you know, what's the latest insanity coming out of this or that place. But because it helps me know what to look out for, what my parishioners might be reading or thinking, or what the church might be, the wider church might be headed toward if we don't head it off at the pass. But
it is like a very intense, you know, it's like the essential oil version of something. Right, you know, you don't take normally 50,000 pounds of lavender and shove it into a little vial and call it natural. Like,
right.
But that's what Twitter is. It's like you've taken 50,000 pounds of people's real opinions about things,
concentrated them
in 240 characters. So it's like being hit really hard with a very powerful aroma of something. And right. Usually it's probably essential oils, I think, generally smell nice. So imagine a really vile smelling substance that you concentrate down. And so there is some, it's not real. Like, that's not really what lavender is like in a little bottle, but it does have there is lavender there. I don't know. It's like, there is some things that are true, or people really do think all this stuff, but it's concentrated and so
more virulent.
And so I don't want to, you know, like, I don't want to just not know what it is or see it or even engage with it.
But you don't want to say this is the real world either.
Right.
So, because that makes me despair when I get to thinking, oh my goodness, this is what.
The sense of apocalyptics, like, yeah, the world is about to end. I do get that every time I wander over there, because I think, oh, well, first of all, if God is seeing this, he will smite us right now because this is so bad. But yeah, so I like these kinds of books. I'm interested in how the human mind, I like Oliver Sacks, how the human mind works, mm-hmm. and how strange it is and what motivates the behavior of people. And I like those kinds of books. So
yeah, it's not very interesting. I would like to read an article like that. Like, just, I could read an article, but a whole book is just, oh my goodness.
I'm reading it at night. It's good. That's and so Cynical Theories and Unoffendable. It's really slow going because I'm reading them all at the same time.
I do want to read a summary of Cynical Theories.
It is really long.
Yeah. It's, you know, really what? Long. It's also, I get so irritated because and I'm sure that book is a good book, but I will get irritated. It won't be a pleasurable reading experience because I'll be thinking about critical race theory and being angry the whole time.
Yeah.
So it's.
Well, I'm not angry. It's interesting because it is describing to me very clearly and helpfully my own college education. Like, I, all you, well, you took history in school. I took literary theory, irony, decadence. I took a class on Algeria. I took a lot of French African lit classes, and those were really interesting. And I did a thesis, and all of it was like basically described in Cynical Theories. Mm. And at the time I thought, oh my gosh, why am I not reading Milton and Shakespeare? But as a lit major, nobody said, hey, you should read Milton and Shakespeare. Everybody was like, here,
read these deconstructionists.
Yeah, read these deconstructionists. So I did, because I didn't know any better. like so many, which is part of the reason that we're in the situation that we're in. So it's helpful if you had that kind of education to the roots of it, where it came from, why it happened to you, and how, you know, because I, none of that really, it bounced off me. Right. Like, I engaged with those texts, but at the time I was like, this is all garbage. This is fascinating and fun, but this is not how people are going to live, and this isn't Christian at all. And now here we are. So that's a good book to read.
It is interesting that you knew, like, because you, one of the accusations of the other side is that we haven't done the work.
So, yeah, I've been doing the work.
You've done, yeah.
I have been doing the work since a child.
Right.
I've been doing so much of the work. And I feel like I really have engaged. My lived experience includes real progressivism and real conservative evangelicals, like super conservative. That's almost Duggar level, but not quite.
That's one thing we're lamenting the other day is that it seems like there are a lot of evangelicals who only have had experience of very, very conservative and sometimes abusively so aspects of evangelical theology. And mm-hmm. so to them, they look at a guy like Richard Rohr and think, oh, he's so interesting. He's so nuanced. He's so...
Yeah.
And no, he's a very shallow Episcopalian-esque...
Yeah. Who's been repudiated thinker. By his own church.
Right. He's not a good thinker.
And, no.
And you, it's old. I mean, you...
Yeah.
It's just regurgitated, reconstituted Gnosticism... repackaged for the 21st century.
Yeah.
And but you know, if you're reacting against your past, then Episcopalianism looks so interesting.
Yeah. Right?
You don't have to leave your brain at the door. You can live the questions. it's no, you don't understand where you're going. Where
yeah, you don't know, like,
you don't see the ugliness of it.
Yeah. And I grieve, as you said, I'm lamenting. Mm. Because eventually that ugliness is going to come up into people's faces, and they are shipwrecking.
Right.
And so, yeah, sure. You don't have to like be super conservative and become part of the Duggars or go to Pensacola or Bob Jones. Like there's a wide berth. You don't have to do that. But be careful that you don't just wildly swing all the way over to the other side, right. Because that's not like, so the heartbreak of maybe Pensacola or Bob Jones is that's really gross. There's some real ugliness there, but you could still hear the gospel. Like somebody's going to stand up and say, hey, you're a sinner and Jesus came to save you from your sins. And you like have to filter out all the other weirdness around that. But if you go and sit in a Richard Rohr thing, you aren't going to hear the gospel at all. You're going to hear in no way. You're not going to be able to be saved because nothing about it is going to help you get to Jesus at all.
Right.
So the lies are really deep, and they're nicer looking on the left than they are on the right. But
the universal Christ.
Yeah.
Sounds really wonderful. I mean, and the fact that he's Satan is obscured, but
he's like literally
right. The universal like, Christ is
literally Satan.
well, it's like I guess going back to my book, I was reading this is like the reporters looking in from the outside at the North Vietnamese communist regime, thinking this is so wonderful.
Yeah,
this is like the workers' paradise. This is utopia.
But then it turns out to be Satan. It's like literally Hitler.
Right.
Right. Stalin was literally Hitler.
Right.
And so was Mao.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this was better than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's okay. I wonder if our listener is going to be.
Our listener is like, oh, okay. And the truck died down.
I'm just going to stop it now.
Yeah. Well, we went all the way up to the 40-minute mark, and the trucks, they drove them all into place, and then they have paused, so that was nice of them. And now I have to get to work, so Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week, maybe.